You're listening to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Heidi Holton with Michael Small. Today we're talking about a new book out in paperback. It's described as a gorgeous meditation on solitude and connection. It's called Rough Beauty, 40 Seasons of Mountain Living. It's by award-winning poet Karen Auvinen, and she joins us now. Karen, thanks for being here.
Heidi, thank you so much.
You're welcome. So Rough Beauty is about a lot of things, and I was struck by how the titles really encapsulated what this story is that you've written. Can you tell us a little bit about what that title means to you and why you chose it?
Well, there's a part in the book where I was camping alone on the Green River, and I was thinking about this kind of tension between when I was a child, I was brought up Catholic, and I was, you know, kind of brought up to think about heaven as this place of perfection, and I would go there someday. And you know, heaven used to scare me. And I was sitting on the bank of this river, and it was so beautiful, the various layers of the desert, and I could see, of course, out there, you can see every single star there is. And I was thinking, this is my heaven. This the earth is my heaven. And I say I prefer the earth with its, I'm not sure if I can say the word, it's shit and it's muck, it's rough beauty. And I like the tension of the beauty of nature, but also the danger of nature. And for me, that's rough beauty. But also, I think my life has been a little bit like that. It's kind of been a kind of wild, beautiful, terrible, amazing, scrappy thing, I think.
You know, I was very struck by how much nature, how much paying attention and to noting the changes in season. We do a program on Tuesdays. It's called Phenology, and that's what it's all about, is noting all the changes in nature due to seasons. We have school kids who call in that what they see. And I know through that program and then through reading your book, it just makes you more connected to something beyond, you know, our phones or all these things that don't always matter that much. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how your life came to be noting the changes in nature like that, or what it means to you.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, noting the passage of the season, or, you know, my practice is to get up every day and kind of write my notebook what's happening outside. And I think what happens is that it starts as a writing practice for me to kind of keep my brain, my busy brain, occupied with details, because once I do that, then writing comes. But the other part is it becomes a meditation. So in meditation, and I've been a meditator for 25 years, I have a mantra. And the mantra keeps the ego part of my brain, the part that wants to be busy, happy, so that I can eventually drop into a deeper space. So I think that paying attention to the seasons keeps us rooted in, you know, in the present moment. And I think that's a great practice. But it also keeps us in rhythm with the year. You know, I'm a big advocate of, if it's cold, put some clothes on and stay inside. Or, you know, or don't wear, you know, like sleeveless shirts in January. Or don't turn your heat up to 72 degrees. I mean, I'm about a 55-degree girl myself. But, I like the idea of following the natural world, because there's an intelligence out there that is way bigger than we are. We like to think that we're smarter than nature, and I just don't think that's true.
We're talking with Karen Auvinen about her book that's out in paperback now. It's called Rough Beauty, 40 Seasons of Mountain Living. And we start this story of your life at a very difficult, very terrible time with a fire. I think a lot of us kind of fear what that would actually be like. Can you tell us a little bit about this experience for you?
Sure. I had kind of taken the most circuitous route to the present moment, which was I had finally decided I was going to be a writer, and I had gotten a master's and took a few years in poetry and took a few years off to work, and then realized I wasn't getting anywhere. So then I went back and got my PhD, and this time in fiction writing. And I had just finished, and I was 39 years old, and I decided I was going to I had been living in the mountains, but I got a plot of land on a pretty remote place, and 8 months later, after I was armed with my 4 part-time jobs as a writer, and I was going to make it there in the woods, and 8 months later, my house burns down. and I lose everything. So I'm a renter. I have no insurance. I lose all my books. I lose most of my writing except for the, you know, transcripts that were filed at universities as dissertation or thesis. I lose everything I had accumulated until that moment. And, you know, I and all of that stuff was hard won. I come from a very blue-collar family, and everything I ever had was just kind of like I scrapped and punched to get it. And so I had to start over at 40. And that was a little stunning. And it was stunning, and also I think I say in the book, you know, I think my friends, particularly my writer friends, may have suffered more in some ways imagining what it would be like. And I think that's a gap, what happens when we experience trauma between us and the people who are watching us. There's a divide, and they don't know what to do because it's so horrifying. Like, how would I respond? And, you know, I knew how I had to respond, and I knew my choices were to, you know, kind of lie down and die, honestly, and just quit, or to keep going. And I kept going largely because of my dog, who was such a pain in the butt. I thought, no one will take care of this dog. I mean, it did cross my mind, you should just stop now. I mean, call it a day. It's too much. And Elvis, the dog, he's a husky mix, he kind of kept me tethered to the earth in a great way. And I thought, well, I got to take care of Elvis. So I just started putting one foot in front of the other and gradually rebuilt my life, but you know, and also learned that you can't do it by yourself and you really need help.
I love your description of how Elvis reacted at that fire, and you know, certainly it was a lot to get through before you could kind of move through that, but his initial reaction kind of pulled you out of it a little bit.
Yeah, you know, so I'm watching my house burn, and I lived rurally, so the volunteer fire department, on that day there was no one on the mountain. It has changed subsequently. They've definitely become they're a better unit than they were then. And they, it took an hour for anyone to get there, and the first thing that happens is that they got stuck in my driveway because it was snowing, and they slid into the, you know, kind of gully. And so anyway, so I'm watching my house burn, and Elvis is in the truck, waiting for me, and he hasn't barked, he hasn't whined, he hasn't done anything. And finally, I realize, you know, my house is nothing. They're not going to save anything. They're pushing in the walls on top of my burning things to keep the fire from spreading to other houses nearby or to brush nearby. It's called surround and drown. So I thought, okay, let's call it a day. And I opened the truck to let Elvis out to go to the bathroom. And he kind of did his thing, and then he found a snowbank, and he, like, flopped over on his back, and he rolled in the snow. And, you know, kind of joyously, like, you know, it's okay. It's just stuff. We'll get through this. And, you know, he really kind of, his humor and his sheer joy in living kind of brought me back to what life should be really about. And even in the face of this thing, like, oh my God, what am I going to do now? The dog is like, it's okay. We'll get through this.
I want to ask you a question that you may be able to answer, I hope. This book is written in the mountains. And how would this book have been different if you'd written it in the plains?
That's a great question. You know, I think I imagine that there would have been even more silence and more space. I mean, in the mountains, I'm thinking about fire. I'm thinking about the kind of wildlife you have in the mountains. So fox and bear, and now I live in a place where we have moose coming through. And so it really has to do with, and I think on the plains also, it's a much warmer climate, depending on which plains you are. I mean, I live at 8,500 feet because I like it cool. And if I were writing the book on the plains, I might be talking a lot about the heat how oppressive I think it is. But I also, you know, I would be talking about the different weather patterns there and the different animals there. But I imagine it would have a lot more space, even though this book has a lot of silence in it and a lot of contemplating. I can imagine, like, my arms would be wide open out on the plains. For some reason, that's the image I think of. But I absolutely think that landscape informs character, and landscape informs how we see ourselves and how we act during the day and in our lives. And so That's a really great question.
Let's talk a little bit about connection. You mentioned the four jobs as a writer and different, you know, you really piece together a life with a lot of different things that connect you to the outside world. I loved any time that you wrote about the Merck for some reason. I want to go to that place, especially Mondays when you were cooking.
They have a legendary, Jamestown has a legendary July 4th celebration, which is coming up, and it starts with, it's an all-day event, and there's a pancake breakfast, and then a little parade in which, you know, all the kids are riding their bikes, and the fire engine goes through town, and there are people on the fire engine throwing candy, and basically most of the town's in the parade, and there's a kazoo band, and it's really fun. And then there are games in the park and bands all day, and then they have fireworks. And this year, actually, I think they're allowed to have fireworks for the first time in about 4 years because it's been so dry, and this spring has been incredibly wet. So the Merck. So this is a place, it's in Jamestown's a town of 300 in the mountains, and it's about 7,000 feet there. And I worked as a cook in the cafe for many years, and that's how I got to know these kind of, you know, funny, strange, infuriating, wonderful mountain people. And one of the things I want to say, you know, I kind of kept my distance at first. I thought, oh, I'm not like these people, and they're whatever. They're this, and I'm that. And the first thing that happens after my house burns down is that the town of Jamestown kind of came to the rescue, like the cavalry. I mean, I would never have recuperated. I would never have come back from this. I didn't have any money. But the town kind of like provided. So, and it was so amazing to me. And this is the moment when I thought, because I had always, I had developed what I call my cowgirl ethos. I'm going to go it alone. I'm going to be independent. I'm going to show everyone that I can. And then I realized in that moment, nobody does it alone. And so they have a benefit. They bid on items. They present me with thousands of dollars to get back on my feet. And we're talking about everybody in town, people I didn't like, people who didn't like me, people I never talked to, people I didn't know. And I thought, oh, this is community. This is what community is like. Community isn't like-minded people forming a circle. Community is a relationship. And that relationship is more important than the individual, so that when somebody needs help, everyone shows up. And that just completely cracked my heart open. And I thought, oh. And they're still my community. I don't live there anymore. I live down the highway about 40 minutes or so because I can't afford Boulder County anymore. But they're still my community, and I'll be there on 4th of July.
Was it hard to accept the help?
It was very hard. In fact, it was embarrassing to me. It was, I was being needy was something I never, ever wanted to be. And part of it was because, you know, I was taught that girls were needy and that girls should be weak. And I thought, I'm not going to be like that. I don't want to be like that. I'm strong. I'm going to be strong. But it was horrible. I mean, I was so embarrassed that they're having a benefit for me. And I kind of haunted the kind of periphery of the big party, essentially, that the town was having on my behalf, and I was just so ashamed. And it took me a few years to kind of really come out of it and kind of look back over my shoulder and appreciate what had been done for me. But so many people were, I mean, it wasn't only the town. I mean, I had people, somebody donated their cabin in the mountains for 4 months, so I had a place to live. Other people went and got, you know, supplies for my dog. People were just kind of coming out of the woodwork to help me. I was a rural postal route driver. I had customers, this is illegal, but I had customers leave me envelopes of money in the mailbox for me. It was really, it was amazing. It was amazing.
So where do you think that kind of do-it-alone cowgirl attitude came from in your life?
I think because in my family, the stories that we told were the stories of men, and the men live legendary lives, and women were supposed to kind of just watch. And I thought, I want to live a legendary life. There's something in me that yearned for something bigger, and so I realized, and I grew up feeling a bit like I was an alien. I tell a story in the book where I'm 10 years old, and I used to get this ringing in my ears, and I was a storyteller even then. I made up a story about, It was my alien family from outer space, and we had come to the Earth, and I had gotten lost. And they were trying to, they had to go back home, but they were trying to tell me in their language, which was the ringing, how to get back home. And so from a very young age, I felt like I wasn't like the people that I was birthed from, my family. I wasn't, and to be fair, they looked at me and thought, oh my God, where did she come from? And so I thought, so I developed this kind of opposition. I'm just going to do it my own way. And I wanted to show people that I wasn't weak. That I could camp by myself, that I wouldn't be afraid of the dark, that I was strong. I wanted to kind of express what I was feeling about myself on the inside to the outer world. And it translated into, I'm going to go it alone. Of course, the other piece is that I grew up in a pretty violent family. And so I think there was a little bit of an aversion to being close to people, too, that got mixed into there. I didn't want to get close to other people because they could hurt you. So I was just going to be a cowgirl and ride off into the sunset.
And I love the what it meant that you changed your last name to your mother's name and really wanted to rewrite that story of the legendary men. Now you're choosing to be named after the women in your family.
Yes, I really felt like it was important to me to name myself. And in college, I had taken this class, women's studies class, that was called Feminist Theology, and we learned a ritual of naming ourselves by our mothers because, you know, in so many families, it's the stories of men that you hear, or you hear about when people are doing genealogy searches, they're searching through the male line, which is fine, but we don't talk about the women. I thought, who are these women? And so I'm Karen, daughter of Susan, daughter of Alice, daughter of Mary, daughter of Valborg, who's a woman in Russia, and on the border with Finland. And so I thought, I'm going to take my mom's name. And it was a revolution, honestly. It was an act of, it was a declaration of war, apparently, in my family. my grandfather basically disowned me, my Italian grandfather. And then my father said, you know, okay, I love you, I support you, but you can't call me by dad anymore. You got to call me by my first name. And I said, no, okay, wait a minute. And then we didn't speak for about 10 years after that. So it's so funny, this kind of, you know, that's that control of, like, you know, I have your name, you have my name, and you will do what I say. And so for me, I sensed that. I wanted to have my own name, and I wanted to also recognize my mother's. And so I took Ovenin. And I didn't ever get rid of my dad's name. It's part of my middle name now. But I wanted them to have equal billing in my life.
So when the stories are told around the campfire about the legend of you, what will those stories be?
Oh, my God. How can you answer that question?
I would say her legendary dinner parties. Elvis.
Yeah, those stories are already being told. I do have legendary dinner parties.
Okay.
I have one every year in February. I've been having it. We just had the 25th one, and it's called it's called the Bugger T.S. Eliot party, and it's because in graduate school I decided that, you know, I was so sick of people telling me that T.S. Eliot was the greatest poet on the face of the planet. I'm so sorry if you love T.S. Eliot. I just couldn't take it. And I was thinking, why not Sylvia Plath? And also because Eliot said April is the cruelest month, and anyone who lives in the mountains knows it's February. It's really dim in February. So I threw this gigantic, dinner party every year, and it has a different theme. And I spend a lot of money and feed my friends. So I think that. But I hope that people will say she lived really authentically. She lived a life of her own making, which I think is the best thing that anyone can do. I mean, I stepped off the path that I was supposed to take, which was to be somebody's wife. She's going to make somebody a good wife someday. And I decided this is the life I want, and I lived it. And I think that's the best thing that anybody can say about. I think that makes anybody a legend.
It's Karen Alvanen. The book is called Rough Beauty, 40 Seasons of Mountain Living. You can find more information at her website. It's KarenAlvanen.com. Thanks so much. It was great to talk to you.
It was great to talk to you. Thank you.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show.